Chapter 9, The Yoga of the Kingly Science and Kingly Secret. The Holy Lord says, to you who argue not, shall I declare this most secret knowledge, which when joined with realization shall free you from impurity. Royal knowledge, royal secret, this the supreme purifier, readily learned by the righteous, easy to practice, eternal. Those without faith in this Dharma return without attaining me to the path of birth in this world, the realm of death, O Arjuna. All this world is pervaded by me in my unmanifest form. All beings do dwell within me, but I do not dwell within them. Nor do beings dwell within me. Behold this my divine yoga, bringing forth and supporting them. Myself yet does not dwell in them. As mighty winds move everywhere, yet always dwell in the ether. Know, Arjuna, that even so do all beings dwell within me. At the end of a kalpa, all beings merge in my prakriti. At dawn of another kalpa, I myself send them forth again. Animating my prakriti, I project again and again this whole multitude of beings helpless under prakriti's sway. And yet these acts do not bind me, sitting as one indifferent and fully unattached to them. This is the truth, Dhananjaya. Because of my proximity, prakriti produces all this. The moving and the unmoving, the world revolves because of this. Unaware of my higher state, as the great Lord of all beings, the deluded disregard me, dwelling within a human form. Of vain hopes, vain deeds, vain knowledge, without sense truly they abide in the delusive nature of the Rakshasas and Asuras. But those great souls that abide in their divine nature, Arjuna, worship me single-mindedly as their eternal origin, glorifying me always and striving ever with firm resolve, bowing to me in devotion, always steadfast they worship me. And others sacrificing by the sacrifice of pure knowledge, worship me the all-formed as one, as distinct and as manifold. I am the rite, the sacrifice, the offering, the offered things. I am the mantra and the ghee, the fire and act of oblation. Father and mother of this world, sustainer, grandfather, the known, purifier, the pranava, the rig sama yajurvedas. Goal, supporter, the Lord, witness, abode, refuge, friend, origin, dissolution and substratum, storehouse, seed imperishable. As the sun I give heat, and I withhold and send forth rain, I am both immortality and death, being and non-being am I. The knowers of the three Vedas worship me by sacrifice, by drinking soma, and thus, made pure from sin, pray for passage to heaven, gain worlds and enjoy pleasures of the devas. Having enjoyed the heaven world with merit exhausted, they re-enter the mortal world, thus keeping the injunctions of the Vedas. Filled with desires, they constantly come and go. Those who direct their thoughts to me, worshipping me with steadfast mind, for them I secure what they lack and preserve that which they possess. Even those who with faith worship other gods also worship me, though with a mistaken approach. This is the truth, son of Kunti. Truly I am the enjoyer and lord of all sacrifices, but because they do not know me, they return subject to rebirth. To the gods go their devotees, to fathers go their devotees, to spirits go their devotees, and to me go my devotees. whoever with devotion offers a leaf, flower, fruit, or water, that I accept the devout gift offered by the pure-minded one. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you sacrifice or give, whatever austerity you do, do that as offering to me. Thus shall you be freed from the bonds of actions both good and evil, steadfast in renunciation, and freed you shall come unto me. I am the same to all beings, to me none is disliked or dear, but those worshipping me devout are in me and I am in them. If even an evildoer worships me single-heartedly, he should be considered righteous, truly having rightly resolved. Quickly he becomes virtuous and goes to everlasting peace. O son of Kunti, understand, my devotee is never lost. Women, Vaishyas, also Shudras, even those born of evil wombs, all those who take refuge in me, also go to the supreme goal. How much more than holy Brahmins and devoted royal sages, having obtained this transient and joyless world, then worship me. With mind fixed on me, devoted, worshipping, bowing down to me, thus made steadfast with me as your supreme aim, you shall come to me. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, ends the ninth discourse entitled The Yoga of the Kingly Science and Kingly Secret.
Good evening and welcome. So we were just listening to the beautiful singing by the beautiful singing of Kamudas of chapter 9 of the Bhagavad Gita, which is a chapter called the Yoga of the Kingly Secret, the Yoga of Sovereign Knowledge. And the sovereign knowledge that Krishna is offering Arjuna is the knowledge of his omnipresence inside the universe. I think what we've seen as we read the text and as we practice with it, what we start to see is that he is coming back again and again to certain key ideas, one of which is that action is a necessity, that we must act according to our dharma. But as he gets in deeper into the conversation, what you realize is that what Krishna really wants to reveal to Arjuna is that who Arjuna is and who everyone in this story is a form of Krishna himself. So the fundamental foundational teaching here, the fundamental foundational truth that he's offering to Arjuna is always the truth of what it is that is at the heart of everything. In other words, Krishna himself as the underpinning of the universe. So this is a text that comes again and again and again to the tantric truth of non-duality. And as I've said earlier, I believe, and many, many others who are schooled in the non-dual tantric traditions believe, that the Bhagavad Gita really is a text of tantra. We're going to start, or we're going to continue by chanting the invocation, in which we salute Krishna under the name of Madhava, which means the sweet one. We salute Madhava, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and lets a cripple cross mountains. So you can find your posture. And in finding the posture, please pay particular attention to the position of your sits bones against the seat and begin to feel the presence of the central channel, the Sushumna Nadi, running from the perineum at the base of the spine all the way up through the crown, and feel that the Sushumna Nadi is actually the force that holds your body upright, as well as the force within which the ascending Shakti, which we are beginning to understand is as key to the secret teachings of the Bhagavad Gita as it is to the more traditionally central channel-oriented teachings of Tantra. So let the breath flow through the Sushumna Nadi, flowing in as though from the center of the forehead down to the heart, flow up from the heart through the crown of the head, and see if with each inhalation you can more deeply connect the breath to the base of the body, to the Muladhara chakra at the base of the spine, and with each exhalation see if you can allow the breath to move more freely through the Sushumna. And we'll chant. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripatam aham vande paramananda madhavam. Two more times. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripatam aham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam pangam langayate giram yat kripatam aham vande paramananda madhavam. So the breath flows in through the third eye, through the center of the forehead, down through the heart, down to the Muladhara chakra, and then back up through the crown. And with each inhalation and each exhalation, we allow ourselves to turn in, turning inward with the recognition that the breath, the intention, the will that is creating in us the capacity to turn our awareness inside, even imperfectly, that the central channel within which we are focusing, that the body itself, that the thoughts, pleasant or unpleasant, that are arising, all of these are fully imbued with the presence of that underlying divine consciousness, which is Krishna. So letting the breath flow in the central channel. Open your awareness to invite in the recognition that all this is permeated by that one who is narrating to us the process of sadhana, which I know for many of you, as it is for me, is turning out to be pretty much a master class in the inner yoga. Krishna is the master, and we are experiencing his teachings through the extraordinary text, the Bhagavad Gita. Let me tell you what we'll be doing today. I want to discuss chapter 8, which is the chapter in which Krishna actually describes the after-death journey, which is always one of the most important things we can pay attention to in our practice. We'll also be, let's say, taking a tour through some of the middle chapters of the Gita, chapters 9 through 12. To my kind of amazement, we have come to the fifth week of the class, so next week is the last week. And that in the final week, we really are going to kind of deeply enter into the last two chapters of the Gita. So this week, rather than go chapter by chapter or verse by verse, especially because the middle chapters actually reiterate some of the same points that are made both in the first six chapters and the last six chapters, we're going to speak about the journey and about the actual practice of devotion, which is so much the essence of chapter 9 and so much of the Gita itself. And we're also going to have a Q&A session, and of course we'll be meditating. I want to just speak to a couple of the questions that have come up on the listserv this week, having to do with, first of all, some of the questions, let's call it the samskaric impressions that are raised when Krishna says something like, take refuge in me and then you'll come to me. The Bhagavad Gita is an integral text. And what that means is that it's a text that actually makes room for all religious positions. Like the Bible, you know, like the Old Testament and certainly the New Testament, it's been around for a long time and people have approached it from many different perspectives and many different levels of consciousness. And part of what we learn to do in studying a text like the Gita is to find that in the text which most accords with what we understand to be the non-dual truth, because our practice is really the practice of coming to understand the world and ourselves as expressions of a single divine consciousness that appears everywhere. The Gita, however, in its beautiful application to the lives of everyone who has ever read it and followed it, the Gita also makes room for the dualistic perspectives. And as some of you know, many of the commentators on the Gita have come from dualistic traditions. So, for instance, Swami Bhaktivedanta of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, as well as the teachers of other traditional Vaishnava sects, take statements like of Krishna's, like, those who worship other deities, deities of the astral realms or ancestors, go to those deities, whereas those who worship me come to me. They take this as a sort of an imperialist statement about the superiority of their form of the divine over other forms of the divine. And when we hear these words or when we practice meditating on Krishna or saying the mantras associated with Krishna that we've been working with, Om Namo Narayanaya, it often raises for us a kind of a contradiction with the mantras and the practices that we've been doing in other situations. And we begin to wonder, is Krishna an exclusive deity form, and is contemplating Krishna in some way in contradiction to my other practices or to the other mantras I've been doing, or to, in the case of many of you here in this class, is it in contradiction to my relationship to the divine feminine, to the goddess? And what's very important to understand, you know, especially because most of us really do have lots of dualistic samskaras, as is natural because we've spent many lifetimes in different forms of dualistic religion in which we think of the relationship with the divine as being more of a god-slug relationship than a relationship that's with our own inner self as a divine, as a manifestation of the divine. So sometimes when we read Krishna's statements, they put us into various forms of contradiction. And what that comes from, I believe, is a very deeply buried set of understandings that could be called ethnocentric, that come from the cultures, from the old cultures in which our religion was an extension of our ethnicity, of our tribal function, of our membership in the particular culture or group that we belong to. And as, again, as many of us know, different regions tend to be dominated by particular religious traditions. And of course, there's an enormous conversation going on in this country and around the world between fundamentalist forms of religion, ethnocentric religion, and the spiritual understanding of people who have developed past the ethnocentric view of life and are actually able to look at different spiritual and religious perspectives together. Indian spirituality, Indian religion, has a deep tradition that there are many paths to the truth. So the monotheistic illusion that has been present, say, in the Abrahamic religions in their more ethnocentric form has not taken root in the same way in Indian religion. But that said, the same tendency to say, you know, my deity is better than your deity, or my deity is the only true deity, is also present in Hinduism, because human beings in our natural development go through stages of development where it's very hard for us to see spirit as being all-pervasive, and in which it's very natural to us to believe that our form of worship or our form of understanding is the only truth. When we find in ourselves a feeling of contradiction, for instance, saying to ourselves, is it okay to call the divine Krishna while also calling the divine Durga, we should understand that this is a natural remnant of our early experience of believing that the name we give to the divine confines divine consciousness to a particular form. And as I say, I don't think there's anyone who doesn't hold that recognition within ourselves. I had an experience years ago which made me see how deeply fundamentalist I am capable of being. And it was one of my very early experiences of darshan, that is, of actually having a, let's call it a visitation from a subtle being. And as it happened, I was reading a book that a friend of mine had given me about the Divine Mother in the form of Mary, the mother of Jesus. And I was reading the chapter on the Virgin of Guadalupe, which some of you may know is a vision which appeared to an Indian devotee in Mexico in the 16th century, and who now is the center of worship of the Divine Mother all through the Western United States, and as well as in Mexico and other parts of Central America. So I was reading about her when suddenly in the air in front of me appeared this shimmering presence, and it wasn't really visual, but it was very definitely a divine presence, and it began to literally send rays of love through my heart and to speak to me. And basically what it was saying to me is, I'm here, I'm the mother, I will help you, turn to me, take refuge in me, very similar to what Krishna is saying to Arjuna, perhaps because this is what the divine always says to us in whatever form the divine comes. And as I experienced this presence, my ordinary mind was going, now wait a minute, is it okay for me to open to this energy? Because after all, I have a tradition and I have a teacher and it's not a Christian. You know, I have a guru and I come from a tradition that believes in one point of devotion to a single form. Is this okay? And this whole kind of wrestling match occurred within my mind. And I would should tell you that this vision, this apparition, this presence stayed with me for a couple of days, during which I went through this entire process of rejecting it and then coming to recognize that, duh, I was being given a gift. The name that a manifestation of the divine calls itself is completely irrelevant. What matters, of course, as you know and I know, what matters is our ability to open to this sense of presence in whatever form it comes. So in reading the Gita, as in all spiritual experience, in all spiritual reading, in all opening into the mystical, it's very important to keep coming back to his over and over again repeated injunction to recognize him in yourself and in everything, and to recognize that he is not a he any more than she is a she, because when we talk about the divine, we talk about that presence which lives through all different forms. Again, just see if you can feel the presence of the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel, and let the breath flow in through the center of the forehead and down towards the Muladhara Chakra with the inhalation and back up with the exhalation. So in one of Krishna's statements to Arjuna at the very end of chapter 7, which is the chapter that we worked with last week, he speaks about the different forms, the different ways in which a seer or a yogi can tune into the experience of Krishna. He says, those who strive for release from old age and death, by which he means release from eternal recurrence, from the cycle of reincarnation, those who strive for release from old age and death, taking refuge in me, they fully know the highest self. They know the nature of action. Those who know me as the Adibhuta, the Adidaiva, the Adiyajna, with their minds fixed on me, come to me at the time of death. So Arjuna, in the beginning of chapter 8, starts off by asking Krishna, what do you mean by all these words, by all these terms? You know, what do you mean by Brahman? What do you mean by karma? What do you mean by Adibhuta, Adidaiva? And Krishna explains to him that these forms are different aspects of the consciousness which begins in utter absolute vastness as Brahman. Brahman means the vastness. That is, he calls it the highest indestructible, the eternal transcendent formless truth. So this is one way of knowing the truth. And that Brahman, which he describes also as the Adhyatman, meaning the original self, has the nature of awareness. So what Krishna is saying is that the original self is a continuous flow of consciousness that moves throughout all the worlds, all the time. So in other words, that which is at the heart of this universe, that is the source of this universe, the absolute Brahman, is aware, is conscious, and is conscious, aware, in all times, in all places, and in all things. This is the secret. This is what he calls the yoga of the sovereign knowledge, the kingly secret. So this continuous awareness that is the nature of the absolute is called in Sanskrit his swabhava, which means own nature. This great Sanskrit word, swabhava, which literally means true nature, your natural self, is consciousness, is total awareness, both in the absolute and in you. Now, you know this. It's one of the great teachings of the direct path traditions. So the Swabhava of the absolute, whose nature is awareness, is awakeness, expresses itself, flows continually as awareness, and that awareness, that, you know, that constant flow of consciousness has the quality of absolute freedom. This absolute freedom is what in the tantric tradition we call Shakti. In other words, the absolute freedom of consciousness ever flowing has this quality of creativity and power, which is inherent in the divine being. And this power of freedom, this power of Shakti, which constantly bubbles up from within the divine source, emanating from within the absolute, manifests as what he calls the Adibhuta, which is the substance out of which the material world is manufactured. So this flow of consciousness with its innate power to manifest becomes the substance of this entire material world, of that which is perishable. So one of the ways to know the divine is as the innate substance, the life force within the material world. Again, this is one of Krishna's most important teachings. One who knows me as the Adibhuta, the substance within all that which lives and dies, knows me. Again, he says, one who knows me as the Adideva. Adideva means original deity. Deva means deity or God or light form. The Adideva is the inner self, Krishna says. The original deity is your inner self. I don't know why this particular teaching always literally sends thrills up and down my spine. It sort of makes the hairs on my body stand on end. It's a very, very classical teaching of the Indian traditions, of the non-dual traditions. It was my guru's teaching, God lives within you as you. But it's a teaching that if we really find it, if we really feel it, it has this capacity to just completely illuminate our experience of our own intuition, of our own devotion, and especially of our experience of ourself. So remember this statement about, you know, you who know me as the Adideva, the Adibhuta, comes at the point where Krishna is talking about how those who worship other deities, by here he means lesser deities, such as the elemental deities like the sun god or the thunder god. In Indian mythology, these are the gods Surya, Indra, Varuna, the god of waters, Vayu, the wind god. They are all the elemental powers that operate, we could say, as the overseers or the governors of the physical world. And if you're, you know, familiar with mythology, with intercultural mythology, cross-cultural mythology, you know that the Greek gods, Apollo and Zeus and Aphrodite and Athena, are actually the same kinds of deities. They are, in other words, they're not the absolute. They are powers within the world, within the universe, who are capable of giving us enormous help and benefit, can also cause a lot of mischief. If you're aware of Greek mythology, you know that the Greek gods caused a lot of trouble in the human world. But they're powerful but limited light forms who ultimately arise from and subside into the self. that is to say, into yourself, into the subtle consciousness that is your true self. So I find this very important, because what it helps us to see is how these powers, which are celestial powers, cosmic powers, actually have their root in us. They have their root in our own deep self. And what Krishna is saying here is that these elemental deities arise out of him as the source, because remember, he has said to us, and we'll say again and again, that he is the source of everything, and that whatever we worship and pay attention to ultimately is connected to his being and will be rewarded through him. But what he's also saying is that, these powers arise out of your consciousness, not your egoic consciousness, not your limited consciousness, but the inner awareness that is sometimes called the witness consciousness, which is within you, but which also transcends you, and which is the presence, the consciousness that we enter in deep meditation. So as we enter into meditation through the Sushumna Nadi, I want to take a moment here to remind you of one of the great tantric teachings of the Kundalini tradition, the tradition that approaches yoga as the opening of the chakras and the rise of the elemental Kundalini Shakti through the Sushumna Nadi. If you'll remember, along the Sushumna Nadi, in all, each of the chakras, there are elemental deities. So the different deities, the goddess of earth, Prithvi, lives in the Muladhara chakra. The god of waters lives in the second chakra. The god of fire lives in the third chakra. So what Krishna is really saying is, connect yourself to your own inner being, to your own inner body, where all deities reside. It's a very famous tantric verse. It's a very famous tantric teaching that the body, the human body, is the home of all deities, of all divinities. So part of what this can help us understand, and this is part of the lore of living a spiritualized life, a divine life, is to begin to recognize how when we are inwardly connected to the elemental energies in our own soul, in our own subtle body, we are also connected to those elements in the outside world. Of course, this is a very powerful and significant teaching of the shamanic traditions. And if you've ever done shamanic practice, you know how powerfully your inner connection, your connection to those elemental qualities within yourself, begins to be mirrored in the external world. I used to have a very close relationship with the fire element, and I can remember feeling at times that I could actually talk to the fire, to a bonfire, and I would get teachings from the fire. I know people who, in fact, one of my close friends is meditating on the sun, which you have to do at only at particular times of day, because otherwise it will, burn your retina. So you only do it when the sun is halfway down in the sky, halfway down the horizon. But what he says is that teachings come to him from the sun, and that part of what you realize it is that those teachings seem to be coming from the energy outside yourself. But as he told me, what you realize eventually is that they're actually coming from within you, from that part of your soul, of yourself, that's connected to these great elements. So Krishna is encouraging us as he talks about the worship of deities, which was, of course, a very big deal in the culture where Arjuna was brought up, to recognize that these these cosmic energies are real, they have power, that when we attune to them, they give results. They can give us enormous rewards, but of course they're limited in their nature, and they are connected to the aspect of the universe that is below Maya. In other words, they are individuated entities who do not have the capacity to, in and of themselves, take you into complete union or merging with the absolute divine, with Brahman, with Krishna himself. However, what I call the great deity forms, that is, the forms that we call, that in Sanskrit are called forms of Ishwara. Ishwara literally means divine ruler. That is what in the West we call Godhead. That the great deity forms like Shiva, Vishnu, Durga, Kali, Lakshmi, Lalita, Krishna, Rama, Bhuvaneshwari, these are faces, actually facets of the diamond of the divine. So part of what the, let's call it, the science of devotional practice teaches us, and I would say that, you know, the Western version of Godhead, what we could perhaps call, what, you know, some call Jehovah, some call Allah, some call Jesus, some call Christ. These are faces of that ultimate Brahman, that Godhead. And these are the forms of the divine that the great mystics have been drawn to. This divine presence that Krishna calls me, but which could easily be called Durga or Shiva, is found at the level of reality that's sometimes called Ishwara Tattva. It's a very slight separation from the absolute that occurs when the process of manifestation is taking place. That is, the undifferentiated absolute takes a more differentiated form as lordship, as ladyship, as it were, and becomes the personal form of the absolute. So when Krishna says, those who worship the gods go to the gods, though it is me who gives the fruit of all worship, he is speaking as Ishwara, as the personal form of the ultimate. And this teaching that by devotional practice, by worshiping a personal form of the divine, whether it's through a specific deity practice or through a mantra, will ultimately dissolve your consciousness into the consciousness of the absolute, is one of the, as I know you know, one of the deep secrets of devotional practice. In my guru's autobiography, which is called Play of Consciousness, The Play of Consciousness, he describes his own journey, his own spiritual practice. And he talks about a vision that he had. He had a very visionary sadhana, a very visionary meditation practice. And he describes what he calls his final vision, which was the vision which in which it was revealed to him that his practice was complete, that he had reached a particular stage of enlightenment, which is the enlightenment that the lineage that my guru belongs to, which is related to the lineage of Jnaneshwar and also to the lineage of Kashmir Shaivism. It's a tradition in which full realization, enlightenment, is not simply a recognition of the impersonal divine. It also contains a recognition of your identity with the personal divine, with Ishwara. And my guru describes how he was sitting in meditation one day, and when he had a vision of Shiva, who was his Ishtadevata, his, you know, that form of the divine whom he was devoted to, And as this vision came before his eyes, he watched it turn into the form of his guru, to whom he was intensely devoted. And then he saw this form turn into his own form. And this kept happening again and again, that he would see the form of Shiva, his personal deity, the form of his guru, and then his own form. And then these three forms merged into his heart, and he realized that he was being shown in a very visual, graphic way, because that was the kind of consciousness he had, that deity, God, Ishwara, guru, and self are one. It's a very, very fundamental teaching of Krishna's in the Bhagavad Gita. And it's this recognition of Ishwara, the personal form of the Supreme, of Guru, if one has a Guru, and of self, it's the coming together of these forms of the divine that Krishna is advocating as the path for entering into the after-death journey. So we are here in Chapter 8, the yoga of, it's called the yoga of the imperishable, the imperishable absolute, and it's the chapter in which Krishna explains what happens to the soul when it dies. So here's what he says, and we started this conversation last week. One who at the time of death, having given up the body, who dies while remembering me alone, that person becomes one with me. Whatever state he remembers at the time of death, this is what he attains because of continuous meditation on that particular state. Now, I want to explain this because it's one of those teachings that is very, very easy to misunderstand. Obviously, all religious teachings have something to tell us about what happens at death. It's one of the great subjects of religion and spirituality. In Hinduism and Buddhism, again, I don't have to tell you this, there's this where there's the understanding of reincarnation, of the fact that we aren't just born once and then go on to a permanent afterlife, as in some of the Abrahamic traditions. In Hinduism and Buddhism, death is considered a station on the journey, but the gift here, the promise that they give us, as opposed to, for instance, the Christians or the Jews who say that at death, if you've been good, you'll go to a heaven world and there you'll live eternally in bliss. The Hindus and the Buddhists say that at the moment after death, we have the opportunity to merge into the absolute and no longer be required to take bodies. And this is considered to be the sort of absolute goal of the spiritual journey. And even for someone who is not sure they want to merge into the absolute, that moment after death is considered the moment when your consciousness is able to determine the next stages on its journey. In other words, if you're fully awake and aware and conscious at the time of death, then your soul will be expanded and taken to literally the place that you desire, which is a pretty important and significant point about our spiritual practice, which becomes more and more significant as we age, because in the classical yogic teachings and in the more ordinary interpretation of the Gita, the idea is that it's what you're focusing on in the exact moment of your death that determines your future, which is, of course, for all of us, a truly unnerving idea, because, of course, what would happen if we happened to be hit by a car while we're walking down the road and say, oh, shit, did we blow our opportunity? So what the non-dual teachers say about this and what Krishna clearly means by this is that it's not what you think of at the moment of death that determines your future, because if that were the truth, then none of your practices would count. You know, if you happen to be anesthetized at the time of death or delirious, then you would go unconscious in your final hours. And it would be like any random person who never practiced at all. So what Krishna intends to tell Arjuna and us is not that you have to remember God at the time of death, but that you have to practice remembering the divine that throughout your life, and that if you practice, then the impressions that you've accumulated will be present at the time you die, and they'll affect your passage. In other words, what happens at death is a continuation of what you've been focusing on throughout your life, because consciousness is continuous. There's no break in the soul's continuity when the soul leaves the body. And this is actually a big thing to contemplate. It's a kind of a radical idea that's behind a lot of the teachings of the Indian and Tibetan traditions about death, this understanding that there is actually no break, that consciousness is retained from lifetime to lifetime, from body to body, that there is no death for consciousness. However, as we know, when the consciousness of Deb leaves Deb's body and goes into another body, there is no memory of Deb's previous body. But what Krishna says is that what actually travels is the accumulated impressions and intentions which you've carried through your life. So when we have practiced and fully immersed ourselves in mantra or in witness practice, our subtle body and our field of consciousness is so permeated with what we have contemplated, what we've meditated on, that the subtle consciousness that has taken the shape of the body, that has lived in the body, actually becomes able to retain its awareness at the time of death, to retain consciousness at the time of death, and then to literally choose its destination. And so Krishna has given Arjuna a practice. He gives him this practice at the end of chapter 8, and it's the practice that we started to do last week, and in fact, we're going to practice it now. So I'll explain to you what Krishna suggests to Arjuna, and then we'll practice it, and then we'll continue with our conversation. The yogi sits in meditation. At the time of leaving the body, the yogi sits in meditation, puts his attention in the Ajna Chakra, in the third eye, imagines the presence of the sun in the third eye, because the sun is the symbol, as it were, of that the great light of consciousness, which is actually what we truly are, and then encourages consciousness to ascend. Now, if you remember back to our first class, you'll remember that one of the things that was said in the very introduction to this class is that the battle of Kurukshetra, the battle that Arjuna is fighting, is also, of course, an internal battle. And what that internal battle, one of the ways that internal battle is experienced, is as the process that takes place in the Sushumna Nadi, in the central channel of our subtle body, as the Kundalini Shakti and our own consciousness moves through, purifies, and dispels the negative qualities and impressions that are said to be carried inside the central channel and that are often said to be associated with the lower chakras, especially the second and third chakras. And one of the reasons why the yogic practice of meditating in the Sushumna Nadi is considered so central and so efficient is because as we learn to allow the breath and the consciousness to enter the Sushumna Nadi, and as the Sushumna Nadi, the central channel, starts to expand in meditation, which I know many of you have experienced, what happens is that the qualities of our egoic self, the stored impressions of anger, grief, jealousy, fear, etc., begin to be dissolved inside the subtle body. And the idea is that as this happens, our individual consciousness begins to naturally ascend. And in a tantric sadhana, again, as many of you know, awareness will flow up through the Sushumna Nadi and into the crown of the head, or that's one way we experience it. Another way we experience it is simply as a kind of expansion of consciousness inside the inner body so that it feels as though inside our physical body we have fallen into a kind of an open spaciousness of consciousness. This is what the yogic texts call meditation inside the central channel, or the expansion of the center. And it's a very classical and beautiful experience of opening in meditation. So the idea is that as we practice this kind of opening and as our consciousness ascends in this way, subtilizes itself in this way, that at a certain point, when the soul leaves the body, it will just naturally enter into that subtle realm, that expanded consciousness. And the expansion that you've experienced in life, you know, in your meditation, will reveal itself to be an opening into the great unlimited field of awareness, the great light of awareness, which is Krishna's consciousness or Durga's consciousness or Shiva's consciousness, and which is actually the truth about who it is that's living in this body. So Sushumna Nadi practice is a tremendously skillful and significant method that Krishna offers Arjuna and us as one of the core practices for being established in the self in life and at the moment of death. But as Krishna tells Arjuna, that's not the only way. And here he's going to begin to talk about devotional practice and specifically about mantra. Because in the tradition of the Bhagavad Gita, the deepest form of devotional practice that a regular person, that is somebody who's not Krishna's best friend as Arjuna is, you know, in a certain sense we could say that Arjuna is just by cultivating his relationship with his cousin Krishna and allowing his love for Krishna to expand, that's his devotional practice. For the rest of us who don't have a physical relationship with a deity form, mantra is the method by which we bring Ishwara, the personal form of the divine, alive within us. So as we practice mantra, we literally ride the mantra into its own essence because, again, as many of you know, the deepest truth about mantra, the tantric recognition about mantra, is that the divine name that you receive in initiation is actually the sound form of the divine. So Om Namo Narayanaya is Krishna embodied in sound. And someone asked a question about mantra initiation, asked me privately, and what I want to say is that when you receive the mantra in this class, you are receiving initiation into the mantra. It's actually being given to you, imbued with the Shakti of that realm which has originated it. So the practice of soaking the mind in mantra, of allowing the mind to merge in mantra, or allowing the mind to merge as we in the practice that we were doing last week of invoking a personal deity and meditating on that deity. These are practices, devotional practices for allowing the mind to merge into deity. So if you have a practice of returning the mind to mantra whenever you remember, or returning the mind to deity, or returning the mind to the inner channel of Sushumna Nadi, then your mind will merge in that. And if your practice has been meditation on consciousness itself, then your mind at the time of death will merge into that. Whatever you meditate on throughout your life is what you experience at death. And as I say, this is meant to encourage us. It's not meant to freak us out. It's not that we're supposed to practice with the hope that we'll eventually have the opportunity to merge into consciousness, because Krishna is much more interested in encouraging Arjuna to live with yoga than to die with yoga. He's simply saying that you don't have to worry, because the practices that you've done will be there for you. And essentially what he says to Krishna is, I will come for you. I will be there for you at the time of death, in one form or another. Let's find ourselves in the meditative posture. And as you follow the breath, see if you can really focus your awareness on that space just above this hard palate that we call the third eye. Feel that the breath rises and subsides inside the third eye. Consider that within this center in the body, within this center in the head, a kind of funnel of light flows upward. And because this is a practice, I'm not suggesting that you should be able to accurately visualize it, but just have the sense that there is this light vortex which is centered in your third eye and then which rises upward. Feel that as the breath flows in, it flows from that light vortex, that light funnel, into your third eye. And that as the breath flows out, you allow your awareness to very gently relax and open. So it's not that you're trying to expand your head or to make anything happen. You're just inviting your awareness to relax and open. And to consider that the feeling we normally have of being a self-identified with this body-mind is just for a moment free. And just for a moment, allow yourself to experience your own consciousness as vast and limitless. Don't worry, you can come right back to being embodied. Just see if you can open to the recognition that you are without limit. That you are a vast, undulating, light form. That the breath, which flows from the very center of the universe, from the very source of prana, is with every inhalation and exhalation naturally revealing to you that your awareness is capable of taking every shape, every form, and can hold all these forms within itself. Just let yourself recognize your own expansive consciousness, your own expansive awareness. And before you open your eyes, with your awareness inside the third eye, ask yourself, in this moment, what is my greatest desire? And see if you can ask the question without an agenda. Allow yourself to be surprised. Allow yourself to allow what arises to be what it is. The question that I would ask you and that I ask myself in these moments is, to what degree has this desire or another deeply rooted desire given direction to my life? And to what extent do I want this desire to carry me to a future life? In other words, is this desire, which is indeed the engine of my future, if only for the next 15 minutes, is this desire the one I want to go with? And I'm suggesting you ask yourself this question not because I want you to judge the desire that came up or try to find a better desire, but just to recognize what is. And to begin to recognize that if it is really true that consciousness is motivated and activated creatively through desire, which is what the tantric sages and Krishna himself says, if it's desire that is giving direction to your consciousness, perhaps intention is a better word for us, but I think that the truth is it's desire. You know, we, in contemporary yogic practice, we talk about intention and sankalpa. But the truth is that each of us is motivated by desires that are not necessarily revealing themselves in words, but which are naturally giving direction to our lives. And because each one of you, without exception, is being carried by a desire, a longing for what we could call peace or freedom or divine love or God. You know, we all, it has just like the Godhead itself, there are different facets to our longing. But what I would say is that if your longing is for peace, then what is occurring in your consciousness is a movement into peace. If your longing is for love, then what is occurring in your consciousness is a longing for love. If your longing is for creativity, then what's occurring in your consciousness is a movement into creativity. So when we sit in meditation in these transitional moments, and I don't just mean the moment before death, but the moment, for instance, as when you sit before going into your day, to consider the form that your spiritual intention takes, that your spiritual desire takes, and to cultivate it is one of the gifts that we can experience from really looking at what Krishna is saying to us. Where we put our desire, where we put our longing, where we put our love, where we put our devotion, this is what is going to bear the greatest fruit for us. So in chapter 8, Krishna actually mentions very briefly some of the worlds to which we can go at death, depending on what it is that we've contemplated in this life. But what he also says, and what is essential in this chapter, is that all these realms can be bypassed by somebody who simply remembers the divine and who allows our identification with our egoic self to dissolve in that remembrance. And what Krishna is going to go on to say to Arjuna in the next chapters is that the more you can marry your desire, your longing, to the recognition that the same divine essence is permeating everything, the more you are on the fast track. The more you are inside Krishna's master class. So as Krishna says, at all times remember me and fight, for if your mind and understanding are always fixed on me, then to me you will surely come. He doesn't mean just at the moment of death. He means moment by moment, life by life. And as Krishna says to Arjuna, immerse yourself in mantra, immerse yourself in the center, renounce your attachment to the fruits of your actions. You know, as he gives these different paths of yoga, he keeps coming back again and again and again and again to his main point, which I'm going to give you from the way it's described in Yaneshwari, because Yaneshwari is so beautiful. In Yaneshwari, Krishna says, whatever you see with your eyes, hear with your ears, think with your mind, or speak, you should know that it's all me. At all times, I am present in everything. Therefore, what that means is that as you practice surrendering your mind and intellect to me, you literally begin to see me in everything. And then he says, if any doubt arises in your mind about this, just practice it. And I will say this to you. If you have any doubt about this, just practice it and you'll find out that it's true. For one who thinks about the divine constantly, the divine is easy to reach. So at the heart of this recognition, that for one who thinks about the divine constantly, the divine is easy to reach, the subtext is that what allows us to think about the divine constantly is to find a way of connecting to the sacred that actually opens your heart. And this is, of course, tremendously important, because if you're doing your practice out of a sense of duty, you know, or because you think it's good for you, or because you're afraid that something bad is going to happen to you if you don't, or for any of the myriad reasons that we do practice, many of which are good reasons, but which are not what Krishna is talking about, essentially the capacity to find a connection to the divine in the heart is really the core of what he means when he talks about bhakti yoga, or the yoga of devotion. At the heart of bhakti yoga is a soft-hearted feeling of connection to the divine, of the connection to God. And my favorite expression of this practice of expressing devotion by tuning into your heart, by finding yourself in the heart, by feeling into the energy of your heart, and then walking through the world with the intention to see the divine in everyone and everything. This is actually Krishna's basic teaching about what the yoga of devotion is. In other words, the yoga of devotion is not about worshiping Krishna's form or worshiping a mantra. The yoga of devotion is actually learning how to tune into your own heart and then find your connection to the divine heart in everyone, in others, in the people in your life. And one of the things that Krishna says is that a yogi who is really in devotion meets everyone and everything with absolute humility, as though bowing down to everyone and everything, including himself. And this is not a practice that is, you know, like super popular in our current universe. It's not the hippest, coolest spiritual practice there is. But it is the practice that connects us most deeply to the mystics. Because one of the deep truths about mystical awareness, when it begins to become a reality, when the heart begins to blossom with it, is that you actually do start to experience this scintillating sweetness, not only in your own heart, but in everything and everyone that you see around you. One of my favorite spiritual texts, which is actually an assignment I want to give you for the week, is by a Christian monk called Brother Lawrence. I'm sure that many of you know this little book. It's a very small little book called The Practice of the Presence of God. And it's in the form of letters. Brother Lawrence is writing to a friend or to perhaps another monastic, and he's telling him about his practice. He's a cook in a monastery kitchen, and he never has time to pray. He can't sing in the choir. He basically never goes into the chapel. He doesn't do any traditional spiritual practices. He just does his work in the kitchen. But what he does is he holds the bhava, the awareness, that God is inside everything he sees. So when he's counting barrels of beer in the storeroom, God is in the barrels and God is in the beer. When he's baking bread, God is in the bread, the flour, the heat in the oven. God is in the kitchen workers. He says there's never a moment in his life when he's not in the presence of God. And he doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to do any other practices. He just pays attention to this subtle divine presence in everything. Now, this is a really, really simple practice, and I think, you know, I think it's one that every one of us can benefit from, whatever the circumstances in our life. Like any devotional practice, it can start out as something that we do because we think it's going to work, or because we want to, we were given it as an assignment, or because we want to experiment with it. But in my experience, if we do it, you know, Krishna says, if you don't, if you doubt this, just practice it and you'll see what happens. If we do it, then little by little we start to experience pleasure in it, and little by little we begin to connect that pleasure with the source of all pleasure, and little by little, just by having the intention to find the presence of God in the world, it starts to become a reality. You know, I mean, maybe the pleasure isn't there in every moment because our normal thought stream arises to take over our consciousness, but nonetheless, as we keep returning to it, as we keep practicing it, you don't have to tune into any particular form or even any particular practice. You just have to have that intention, that desire to feel the presence of God, sacred presence, in the midst of your life. And this, of course, this practice, as we all know, becomes particularly powerful when you try to do it with people that you don't really like or people who give you a hard time. And we're going to do a couple of minutes of that kind of practice in just a moment. When I was living in India, I came across a book by a woman named Mother Krishnabai, who was a very simple, uneducated woman who lived in South India and was a disciple of a great saint named Ramdas. And they ran an ashram together. But before she became, you know, kind of the co-head of the ashram, she was a student in the ashram. And there were many people in the ashram who she didn't like or she thought were mean to her. And she was spending a lot of her life in a state of great negativity, which is probably not totally unfamiliar to some of you. And she devised this practice where every time she had a negative thought about somebody, she would choose that person as the object of devotion. And the way she would do it was she would get up in the middle of the night and she would go to where this person was sleeping, and she would touch their feet or kiss their feet, or in other words, she would honor them in the traditional way that people in India honor elders or gurus. And she said that by doing this, by practicing devotion to people she didn't like, she gradually cured herself of disliking people. Another practice that is really great for using devotion to transform your relationships is to actually include such people in your daily practice. So if you have an altar, you put a photograph of the person you're having trouble with on the altar. And then every time you look at the photo, notice whatever negative feelings or resistances you have. You ask yourself, can I see the divine in this person and also in the negative feelings? And as you keep doing this, gradually, little by little, you become able to experience this divine presence actually as the factor that holds everyone and everything in your life together. And of course, you can do this with your own qualities. So if there's something in yourself that you dislike or that you have a hard time accepting, write it on a piece of paper and place the paper on your altar. My sadness, my feeling of entitlement, my despair over the state of the world, my lower back pain, my fear, write that down and put it on your altar and actually take a moment to honor it as an expression of God, as a manifestation of the divine. So we're going to do that meditation now, a meditation which Krishna is going to actually describe very specifically to Arjuna later. See everyone as me. Have no ill feeling for any being. Feel friendship towards all beings. So the practice is to imagine someone in your life whom you have a very hard time with. And this could be just someone you're temporarily annoyed with, or it can be a figure from your past, or it can be a public figure. So just imagine this person present with you. See if you can feel the feelings you have towards them. And for some of you, just imagining that person in this context will have dissolved all negative feelings. So that's great. But just imagine for a moment that this person embodies particular divine qualities, and you'll know what the divine qualities are that this person embodies. Even if you dislike them, you know. So just hold this image of this person whom you dislike, or whom you're annoyed with, or whom you're having trouble with. With the thought that this person is an emanation of the divine in a particular form. And ask yourself, okay, how does this person reveal divinity? Is it in their eyes? Is it in their skills and talents? Or is it just possible to feel into their presence? And recognize them as a human being whose every pore is connected to divine consciousness, is expressing divine consciousness. The Buddhists, of course, would say, think of this being as desiring happiness just as you do. Think of this being as having once been your mother. These are beautiful practices for connecting to others. But what Krishna is suggesting is look at this being as being me. In other words, look at this being as a form of the divine, as a scintillating, sparkling light being filled with love and glory. And now, as if you were doing a meditation on a deity, feel that this being, whether you're visualizing them or just experiencing them as a particular energy or as a thought, imagine this being dissolving into luminosity, dissolving into particles, and breathe the particles of this person into your heart. And then just let the heart continue to soften. As though your heart could create a soft center to hold this person. And then inwardly bow to this person and bow to yourself. And in just a moment, we are finally going to take some questions. I wanted to give you guys a chance to actually ask some questions. The question can be about the practice we just did, or it can be something to do with your practice or with the text itself. So if you'd like to ask a question or say something into the space, you can raise your hand. And Deb will facilitate getting you onto the call.
And you need to press press star 2 to raise your hand.
Thank you, Deb. Press star 2 to raise your hand.
It's someone from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi.
I think it's Christine.
Okay.
It is.
So you're on the air. Hi, Christine.
Hi there. One more question about this practice that you just did.
Yes.
So if it causes a real tightening and cramping in the heart, you've told us before we can burrow into something with expand. Can you just a little more?
You mean about how to work with the feeling of contraction in the heart?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, please.
So, yes. Okay. So, I'm going to give you a particular practice connected to this, connected to what Krishna would say. So, see if you can imagine that a divine being is holding your heart in her hands or in his hands. That your heart is being embraced by the gossamer hand, the gossamer embrace of a loving form of the divine who is actually able to hold this person through you as well as hold you. And breathe. And just tell us what's going on.
Well, this person is really just a mirror for like my mom and abuse. And so then just the beauty of having the gossamer shimmering love here for me and holding that, it's just... it's waves and just waves of love. It's beautiful.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And it's expanding out and, yeah.
It's beautiful, Christine. Yes, the power of personal devotional practice. It's really amazing how powerful that is in a, when you feel contracted. So thank you, and thank you for asking that question.
Thank you. I'm in bowing. Thank you.
Thank you. Deep bow to you.
Okay, we have someone in Oakland, California area.
This is Patricia. Hi.
Hi. So what a divine class, Sally. It's a deeper question than it may sound, but I have, a natural inclination to being a mystic and the deep heart's desire to merge with the light and the divine and the love, infinite love, and some considerable capacity to feel that and do it, that's growing more and more, in part thanks to your teachings. But my question is, I'm kind of a secular mystic, is I have a barrier to believing in the divine that is beyond, you know, beyond existence, you know, that something separate, and you're saying it's one. But to me, I get caught in, what does divine mean? Or how can I embrace the divine when I don't necessarily believe in a God or Krishna, but I experience this loving, boundless love, you know, light and love. And so I call it divine. And yeah. I just want some help with the language or the metaphysics, because I struggle with it, particularly when I teach.
Yeah, it is actually a very deep question for secular mystics, because first of all, most of us carry a lot of memories of what some modern thinkers call the cruelty of religion, and plus we don't necessarily have any evidence that there is such a thing as personal deity. So what I have found is that what you're really experiencing and calling divine is love itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that love is God. God is just a word, and divine is just a word, and love is just a word. And sacred is they're just all words that that people have come up with to describe this inevitable suchness that you particularly experience as expanding love. And mm-hmm. I think the faith that we are asked to hold is the faith that our deepest experience is our connection to something that's beyond the understanding of our mind.
Mm,
you know,
for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and beyond a separate self, it's so luminous.
And beyond the separate self, yeah.
Fused in
the separate self.
Yeah. This is helpful. And I'm hoping to take your course in May. I'm planning to, if there's room. And I'd really love to discuss this more, because it's so...
Yeah.
Yeah, the feelings that you generate and inspire me are so ecstatic and beautiful, and the passion of my life. And yet the language is not the language is difficult. I don't find it difficult. I just can't embrace, my metaphysics don't go where my experience goes. And
I totally understand. I totally feel.
I still persist, you know. It's not like I'm defeated by that. But I'd love insights in a deep way with that. And you've really been helpful in your comments just now.
Well, let's see if we can, just discuss this a little bit more deeply next week, because I realize it's a real issue for a lot of us. I just want to say, when I was first practicing, those many years ago, and I was with my guru, who was very, very devotional, a devotional non-dual Hindu, and he was a worshipper of Shiva. He was a worshipper of his guru. He talked about God all the time, and I used to call it the G word, because I was so didn't relate to personal deity. And what I started to how I dealt with it at the time was, I would say to myself, well, the meditations that he teaches me, the feeling I have when I'm around him, are deep, powerful, transformative experiences. He says it's God, so for now I'm just gonna take it that there's something I don't know and wait to see if it's revealed. And for me, studying Kashmir Shaivism and the Kashmir Shaiva metaphysics was very helpful. But it actually took years before I was I was able to call that presence God and feel comfortable. So it feels to me as though something unfolds in the process of accepting the experience of love as not just an individual self-experience, not just an experience that belongs to you, but actually as a glimmer or a glimpse or a partial opening into that which the universe is made of. You know, what, you know, the evolutionary eros, the great allurement that creates all this. So maybe that's the language that works best for you. But yes, we all have to find a way of coming to terms with what we experience and connecting it with a metaphysics that we cannot resist. And I honestly would say that in my experience, you don't have to believe in God or believe in the metaphysics to have the experience and to trust that the experience is going to transform you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I trust all that.
Yeah, I know. And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia, for that question. And thank you for being here.
Oh, I certainly have been. It's a great joy.
And you are a great joy. So are there any other questions? Anyone else want to say something in this space?
I don't see that I have anybody else.
Okay, so...
Oh, I've got a question. Wait, I've got a question that came in from the webcast. So they say, back to the conversation of elementals, is this the same as the archetypal dimension? Oh, I'm going to text this to you because I'm not going to
as
well.
I get the question.
Okay.
And yes, the answer is yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. The Sambhogyakaya. Oh, okay. Yes. This is a question from a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner or someone who has practiced Tibetan Buddhism. Okay, so I'm going to read it. Back to the conversation of elementals, is this the same as the archetypal dimension in Sambhogyakaya in Buddhism? Question two, in what ways can I... So she asked, or he asked, how can I honor you for bringing this at this time? This person felt that their aversion to Trump, who maybe some of you worked with in this meditation, when you put that thought into your heart, you could let him dissolve into luminosity. So the real thing is, how can I love and still in the same moment have experienced such a dislike for the man that arises? And this is the eternal question, isn't it? That there is this love, which is the deepest truth, and then there is also the dislike and aversion that we feel for certain aspects of the universe and certain people. And this practice of actually self-consciously offering love or offering honor or offering worship or holding an object of dislike in the heart is one of the ways that we use our knowledge and our practice and the presence of grace to see through the form to the essence that is present in all of it. And I know it isn't particularly easy with someone that we have an intense dislike or aversion to. And we could apply that, you know, not just to people, but to certain places and certain situations. So what I would say about this practice is that if we can do the practice with someone for whom we have a violent dislike, and hold it in our heart and allow the luminosity to begin to arise and allow the contraction that can arise in the heart around it to dissolve, it won't just dissolve your aversion to that person. It will dissolve a whole string of aversions that kind of come along with it. That, in other words, when you have an intense aversion to a person or a place or a belief or a situation, it carries with it an entire trail of associated images and beings. And in beginning to dissolve that particular aversion, you dissolve a string of aversions. And again, remember, Krishna says to Arjuna, remember me and fight. So you don't have to, the point is you don't have to have aversion in order to stand up for justice or do, you know, or stand up for creating a reality that you feel is more in line with what you believe to be the good, the true, and the beautiful. The feeling of aversion is the reaction of the ego to that which annoys or limits it or in some way challenges the ego's experience of pleasure. And this is very natural, but it is also an obstruction that we work with in the process of really privileging the deep love that's at the heart of ourselves. So we work with our aversions, and this is a very skillful practice. It's not like you have to succeed in it right at this very moment. You just have to do it with the intention to allow love to prevail. So in terms of the question about the elementals, the more academic question, the idea of the archetypal realm as a domain of consciousness, you know, in which all sorts of archetypes exist that are bigger than our personal egoic self, but exist at a kind of intermediate level in the material world or in the subtle version of the material world. These elementals are expressions of what we could call the intermediate reality or the astral reality that's a form of the relative world that just happens to be a great deal subtler than our physical world and which has an enormous influence on our physical world. So when we tune into archetypal beings, you know, when we tune into, well, let's say when we tune into the natural world, to the spirits in trees, to the spirits in the sky, to the spirits in the sun, to the spirit in the sun, what we're actually tuning into is the archetypal realm within nature that is also within us, and we gradually, little by little, discover our immense connection to the entire living world. So it is a very powerful experience, a very powerful practice to tune into the energy within the natural elements. And even though it's not the ultimate practice, as Krishna says, it is nonetheless a powerful and transformative and rewarding practice. So thank you for those questions. Let us really consider the practice of devotion in a way that doesn't require us to choose a personal deity and, you know, fall in love with Krishna or Jesus, but to start to recognize that that being that we're in devotion to, that love that we're in devotion to, is actually meant to be experienced in ourselves and in the people in our lives. And that when we tune into the people around us and to the natural world around us with the recognition that it's actually an avatar, that the world itself is an avatar for the presence of love and awareness, for that flow of consciousness that Krishna talks about, which manifests as all this, which is never separate from the consciousness that is its source. And so in any moment that we can stop and have the intention to be in devotion to what appears in front of our eyes, to the people that we see, to the life in our own bodies, then what we're actually doing is practicing true non-dual devotion. It's the practice that Krishna would have us live by, live in. Years ago, I was working with somebody who was very, very hard for me, and was quite mean and quite authoritarian and made me uncomfortable. And over time, I found that she was just an amazing teacher for me. You know how we say this about someone who really pushes all our buttons, you're a great teacher for me. Well, this person was a great teacher for me. And the way I finally came to understand this principle that we've been talking about happened one day. I was sitting with her, and I found myself looking into her eyes. And as I looked into her eyes, I actually experienced the life spark, the awareness spark that was seeing through her eyes. And I recognized that that same awareness spark in her was also in me. And I just had a moment of recognizing that what it means to say that God is in everybody. In other words, the life spark, the awareness, the love spark that appears in these bodies and gives life to these bodies is itself divine, is itself truth, beauty, and goodness. So as we go into the week, let's go into the week with the intention to see the divine in everyone in whatever way we can, and we have to find our own creative way of doing this, our own tricks for doing this, our own language for experiencing this. Okay, I see Aaron's hand is up.
I've unmuted you, Aaron.
Oh, you muted Aaron. Okay, so do you want to unmute him?
I unmuted him.
Oh, okay. Aaron, are you there? Okay. Aaron is in silence. So
I have a question from Lauren also. It says, too many mantras. I love the last mantra that you gave us, yet I use several others that I've collected as well as a Vajrayana mantras that stirs
Vajrayana mantras.
Into the mix. Please, I'm confused.
Oh, yes. This is the issue of many mantras. Because this is the last minute or so of our class, I'm not going to answer this in detail, but my intention is to speak to this question before the end of this class, because I know it's a question for several of you. What I would say is, for now in this class, practice Om Namo Narayanaya, practice the mantra that you've been given, because that mantra is actually infused with the energy, with the Shakti of the Bhagavad Gita and of Krishna's teaching. So so don't allow confusion to stand in the way of your practice. And I will send out a note about this with the homework, and then we'll discuss it a bit next week as well. So thank you for this question, and thank you all for being here and for practicing and for that moment that occurs in our collective practice when it really feels as though all the hearts, all the consciousnesses have joined. And we really do experience, I'll speak for myself, the presence of that which is called the divine in the Sangham and in the hearts that connect each of us to all of us. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful week. The class will be available as an MP3 tomorrow, and you'll be getting a homework assignment. So much love to all of you. Namaste. Om Namo Narayanaya. Good night.